In one of the steps of the AA program, we make the statement that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now immediately the thought comes to our minds, what do we mean by sanity? And once having sanity restored, what are the methods we can use to continue along a sane life, to continue in this sanity? Well, sanity comes from the Latin word sanitas. That means healthy. It does not refer to the body, nor to the mind, nor to the soul. It refers to the personality. And therefore, the sane person is one who has a healthy personality, who has learned to and continues in a state of adjustment to life, to reality, to people, and to himself or herself. Now, in this question of sanity, there comes the problem of the emotions, or what we call neurotic trends. Psychiatrists say neuroses. And many people will ask themselves or ask someone else, am I a neurotic? Can I tell? Is there any way I can tell if I'm a neurotic or not? Well, I'm going to tell you how, a very simple way. There might be psychiatrists that don't agree with me, but at least it answers the question for me, and I believe it would for most members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is, the so-called normal person reacts most of the time to reason and intelligence. The neurotic person reacts most of the time to feeling, to emotions. And there you have the differentiation. The more I react to feeling instead of intelligence, the more neurotic I am. The more I react to intelligence instead of emotion, the more sane, the more normal I am. Now, we were given 12 steps in AA. And you who have been in AA any length of time at all know that those suggested steps are a philosophy of living. They are guidelines to enable us to readjust again to reality in life, which means to sanity in life, to keep the sanity we have. However, with the modern stresses and strains of life, I feel that most of us need a little more up over and above the 12 steps to control many of the emotional tendencies that we find within ourselves and many of the emotional problems that come along day in and day out. So this evening I'm going to try to give you the best I can what I call certain definite techniques. Techniques that we can use to control the emotional side of our personality. Techniques that will enable us more solidly to adjust to life and reality, and techniques that will enable us to remain more stable in the life we live in this world with people and with ourselves and with reality. Now, I've picked these up over the years. Many of them I've taken from what we call Recovery Incorporated. Now, for those who don't know, Recovery Incorporated is a group of neurotic people with emotional problems who together meet and as a group solve these problems. And they have various techniques to do that. Those techniques which I feel are beneficial to us, I will also try to give you. Now the first one of these techniques, and it's so elementary a statement that perhaps you might be amazed, but it's very fundamental. And that is, keep life simple. You know, most life is simple. We make it complex, or as the guy said, we screw it up. The 12 steps are very clear. The language in the 12 steps, the expressions are very easily understood, but we are going to complicate it as we go along, unless we keep it simple. I have been accused of oversimplification. Perhaps I do. But with the fundamental basis of normal living, meaning to keep life simple, I think we would be better off by making it a little bit too simple than trying to make it so complex in the world that is so complex in itself today. Take, for example, my daily life. Everything I add to it begets a need. And what happens? I must fulfill that need. So instead of a simple life, simple needs, I end up with all kinds of complex needs every day. And when I'm not able to fulfill them all, I have frustration, friction, neurotic trends, emotional disturbances. Keep life simple. Now, AA has contributed two great factors to this simplicity of living. And that is the importance AA attaches to the habit of decision and to the danger of resentments. AA tells us that one of our biggest problems is the habit of indecision. And the word itself, decido, means to cut in half. And that's very true. A habit of decision will have the problems of our lives, particularly the emotional problems. Anyone who is disturbed emotionally to any degree is very much a victim to indecision, almost inevitably. Resentments, we know with the alcoholic, will cause again frustration and also cause the craving for alcohol. Now we'll have a little bit more about that in a few moments when we try to see what can we do about resentments. Because recovery handles resentments in a very more definite way than we do in AA. But some of us can use it very handily. Then the next technique is to practice being satisfied. Now, when I use the word practice, that means to do something about it. To make up my mind, I am going to be satisfied with the things that are and not constantly strive with what I think should be and probably never will be. Once again, I eliminate frustration, I eliminate friction, I eliminate neurotic trends and emotional difficulties. Practice being satisfied. If it's not A-okay, well, then it's okay, so I'll accept it. Of course, AA gives us the idea of acceptance in the prayer that we say. Oh, God, give us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And you know what that wisdom is? That wisdom is something that tells us that 99% of the things outside of myself I can't change in this world. 99% of the things inside myself I can change. That's the wisdom to know the difference. And that will give me a great practice in being satisfied, in acceptance. I can lower my sights. You know, one of the big problems of the modern era is that so much is thrust on us as possible, whereas in reality it is not possible. Look at your TV commercials. Dance through your work, you know. All the things are put as possible potentials which are not reality. Reality is not that way. Reality is something objective, something real. And unless I accept those things in life as real, I will have emotional difficulties. Take, for example, husband and wife. What happens between husband and wife? Because we cannot accept reality. What happened? The husband, when he met his wife years before, thought she was so beautiful, so wonderful, that he felt like he could eat her up. And then he married her and wished he had. He met a fictitious person, he married a real person. Practice being satisfied. Then the next technique is, contrary to popular opinion, Almighty God is not the editor of the Reader's Digest. Now, Another amazing thing in our modern world. Why, it was in the Reader's Digest. It must be true. And herein comes the Advertising Council of America for plenty of leveling at. What is their slogan? You see it on your TV screen. Their slogan is to create a need where there has been none. That's the fertile field for emotional problems, frustrations, friction, and all types of neurotic trends. Then the next technique is learn to like people. They're not all SOBs in this world. You know, when we sober up, it's amazing how many nice people there are in the world. And I'm convinced, really, I have given retreats to every segment of society, including priest retreats, nuns retreats, and what have you. And I'm convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt that 90% of all people in this world are doing a good job with what they have to work with. In other words, they're sincerely trying to do the best they can. Now, if we can't like to associate with people, at least we can change our attitude. Some of us perhaps may not be so easily adaptable to association with people, but at least we can quit condemning them, criticizing them, and begin to tolerate, learn to love, and then after loving, learn to like, because like has to do with the emotions. Love has to do with the intellect and the heart. Then the next one is practice cheerfulness. And again, that takes practice. We have to do things cheerfully. Go out of our way to practice it. Look how much difference there is in our daily lives. The phone rings. Hello? Oh, good morning. Oh, it's the boss. Well, how are you? Practice cheerfulness. Then the next one is use adversity. Learn to see through adversity as God's will and not let adversity throw us. Whatever happens, God permitted or He caused it. One of the two. God's will be done. That's what gives the sense of humor, you know, in this world. God has a terrific sense of humor. And if you don't believe that, just for a moment, stop and realize that you and I and all the millions of people in this world were created for the honor and glory of God. He had to have a sense of humor. Many great men in history and women became great not because there were not adversities in their life, but only because of great adversity. Take, for example, Caesar was an epileptic. President Roosevelt was a paralytic. And Ann Keller was blind. But because of these adversities, they used them as stepping stones, not as obstacles to progress. Not something to shed tears in our own self-pity, but to use as stepping stones to happiness here and hereafter. Then the next technique, and this has to do with the Recovery Incorporated program, practice objectivity in life. What does that mean? Practice objectivity means to start with getting off the me, I, we, and us, and getting on the you, they, them, and theirs. In other words, look objectively at this world and not subjectively through me. To get off the habit of judging all things as it affects me. Practice objectivity. Now, how are we going to do this? First, be convinced that feelings are not facts. I remember when I was in a sanitarium. It's nicer to call it a sanitarium. I had to see the doctor every morning. And he would ask me, Father, how are you doing? And I'd say, I feel terrible. He said, Father, I didn't ask you how you felt. I asked you how you were doing. Objectivity. Feelings are not facts. Then the young fellow who had a job for the first time. And he asked the boss to let him off and go home. And the boss says, why? And the young fellow said, because I don't feel well. Just then the boss said, look, my young boy, there's one thing you'll never learn too soon nor remember too long. That most of the work in this workaday world is done by people who just don't feel well. So when it comes to nervous disorder, not what are my feelings, but what are the facts? And the only one that can tell me that is the doctor, not myself. Decide by logic, intelligence, not by feelings. Then pursuant of that comes another one. Feelings not based on facts will disappear under objectivity. Now that might amaze a lot of you people, but it's true. Recovery has used this thousands of times. A neurotic has all kinds of feelings, you know, palpitations, pains, and what have you. And such a person can very well prove to themselves and get rid of those feelings, prove that they are not objective facts by simply pinpoint, where is the feeling? Where does it hurt me? It'll disappear. Because you're making it objective. Or another way is to take out your watch and say, now how long is that going to last? How many seconds? Before 10 seconds have passed, the feeling will have left. If it's a neurotic feeling. If it's not factual. And if the doctor therefore tells us there's nothing wrong with you physically, it's functional, it's emotional, then it's coming from feelings and not from facts. Then another way to practice objectivity is to move the muscles. No matter how bad we feel, how bad our nerves are, we can always move the muscles. We can always do something. I remember about 2 years ago, I had a long distance call from a friend of mine, another part of the country, and she was in a panic. And she said, Father, I'm just in a terrible mess and I can't do anything about it. I said, what do you mean you can't do anything about it? Well, she said, Father, I can't. I just simply can't. I said, now wait a minute. You called me, didn't you? She said, yes. I said, well, did you pick up the phone? She said, yes. And you dialed it? I said, yes. She said, yes. And you gave me the operator my number? She said, yes. I said, well, that means just one thing. That you have hands, feet, lips, tongue, which can move if you want them to. You can move the muscles. Now all you have to do is once more put down the phone, hang it up, then pick it up, dial his number. She had gotten in a mess with some fellow, and thought she was in love with him, and now she found out she wasn't, and she was panicky. Well, she couldn't do anything about it. So I said, take the phone, call his number, and say, goodbye. The amazing thing is she did. She moved the muscles. Then the next technique is self-analysis. Now this is not inventory. Self-analysis or self-diagnosis is never objective. Even the Romans knew that. The Greeks knew it. They had a saying, no one is a judge in his own case. Therefore, the one who thinks they know more than the doctor, or more than the clergyman, or more than the psychiatrist, they are not objective. Then the next practice of objectivity is hesitation is fear. And any action will gradually control or eliminate fear. Fear in the alcoholic in the beginning. Why were we afraid? Some of us didn't know, but action on this alcoholism took care of a lot of the fears. Fear in approaching AA. We hesitated, and thus we got afraid. Fear in taking the 12 steps. A fellow or gal comes to AA, she hesitates in taking the 12 steps, then she becomes afraid. Fear in taking the third step. We're afraid that having found God, we might have nothing else besides, like the character in the Hound of Heaven who said, I fled him down the nights and down the days, in the labyrinthine ways of my own mind I sped. Lest having found him, I would have nothing else besides. We're afraid. Our approach to God, we're afraid. Now there's two types of fear in life. Intellectual fear, emotional fear. One's objective, one's feeling. Intellectual fear tells us of an evil that is present. It is present, and if we act contrary to it, we will not be hurt. For example, the soldier going into battle, he's afraid. He has reason to be afraid. But if he goes into battle anyway, no matter how he feels, he'll conquer the fear. And many, many thousands, millions of people have done this in the wars down through the ages. Emotional fear is not based on fact, is not objective. We're afraid of something that is not endangering us. And there, that is eliminated by ignoring it. Ignoring it. Emotional fear will retreat before neglect. Emotional fear will retreat before neglect. If we analyze it, take it apart, talk about it, it will remain and grow more and more. If we neglect it, ignore it, it will dissipate. Then the next practice of objectivity is don't take yourselves so damn seriously. Now you have that in AA. Many of the club rooms have that on their walls. And that too is a very important technique of controlling emotional problems. Why is the neurotic so mixed up with his emotional problems? Because he thinks he is in the middle of his universe. And that everything that has happened affects him. Whereas actually we're just one little speck. We're not even a big speck in this world of millions and billions of people. Think of the Chinese. The communistic Chinese have 1/4 of the world's population. 400 million people. And we think we're big shots. Again, the ability to see through things. Now, recovery tells us the way to handle this is don't make a federal case out of everything. Look in your laws today of mankind, and there's not too many federal cases. There's a lot of state laws, city, municipal laws, but there's few federal cases that we come in contact with. And that also is in life. Don't make a federal case out of everything. And that's our trouble. Something happens, which objectively is a very small thing, but we make a big federal case out of it. Why didn't he shut up? Why did he call me that for? And so forth and so on. Who's hurt? I'm all disturbed. I'm emotionally upset. Maybe end up in a fight. I might even end up in jail. I don't know. Don't make a federal case out of everything. Then the next one. Anticipation is not harmful if it is calm and not fearful. If it is expectant and not despondent. Now, a lot of people say, well, isn't that getting away from the 24-hour program? No. The 24-hour program in AA says, yesterday is gone. Tomorrow may never come. I have only today to do something about myself. But this says you can also look forward to tomorrow, provided it is with calm and not fear, if it is expectant and not despondent. There's a world of difference between the two. You take the fellow or the gal who looks to tomorrow and she says, oh, I'll never be any good. I'll never be well. I'll never get sober again. I'll never be well emotionally, physically, or what have you. Of course she won't if she says so. You know what recovery calls this? Recovery says that is prognosis. And there's only one person in this world has any business to give a prognosis, and that's the doctor, the psychiatrist, or the clergyman, not ourselves. If it's a moral problem, then the clergyman should give the prognosis. If it's a physical problem, the doctor should give the prognosis. If it's a mental, emotional problem, then the psychiatrist should give the prognosis. If we give it, then we are committing what recovery calls sabotage. What we're doing, we're taking away from the hands of these experts what is supposed to be theirs and not ours. Then the next one is, be tolerant towards our own mistakes. This is so important. So many people, even after they've sobered up and gotten well for a while, and then they blow their stack and then they get mad because they got mad. You know, it's not such a bad thing in life to get mad, but you're in trouble when you get mad because you got mad. Have the courage to make mistakes. What do you think they put erasers on pencils for? And to readily admit them. I made a mistake. It's over with. Instead of crying in my own tears of self-pity or criticizing myself. Now, this is the most difficult job you're going to have in life. To forgive yourself. To be tolerant towards your own mistakes. The most amazing thing to everyone in life as we grow older is to realize that after all these years, I'm not a whole lot better than I was 10, 20, 30 years ago. I still lose my temper. I still get mad. I still talk about people. I still do the things I did 20 years ago. But you're in trouble when you get disturbed about it too much. Keep on keeping on, day in, day out, but not worrying whether we fail or whether we succeed, because after all, God is not going to worry about it. You know, the human employer demands results. God does not. God only demands effort. And I've said this before, and it bears repeating time and time again. When we come to judgment day, it's not going to make any difference whether we won or lost, but how we played the game. That's so true. God's not going to ask us how long we were sober or how sober we were, but how much did I try? And that's the reason you see some of these guys and gals in AA who have slips after slips after slips after slips, and so many other pietistic-type individuals that would like to kick them out, you know. But they have goodwill. One of these days, here or hereafter, they're going to make it. Then the next one is the realization that perfection is the rarest of virtues. There are not many people who are perfect in life. Believe me. And the few who are, we're not going to know it until they're dead at least 25 years, because it takes that long for a person to be canonized. Now, this demands that we learn the practice, and again, practice means putting forth the effort, the actions of redoing this day in and day out, the practice of averageness and getting rid of exceptionality. In other words, all of us are average people. Let's face it. This is an average audience. There's nobody exceptional in here. And we get in trouble when we think we're above the group, or below the group, or we fight the group, because then we're being exceptional, not average. And the strange thing is that he who thinks he is above, below, or against the group is exactly the one who is not. He's usually very average. Like the guy who jumped out of the basement window to commit suicide. Then the next technique is practice the will to bear discomfort. The reason many of us are so jittery and nervous is because we cannot bear discomfort. We're looking towards that plateau of no pain, you know. That's the first push towards escapism. Remember in the drinking days? What do you think we were drinking? We wanted to get the plateau of no pain. And the amazing thing is, the more we sought it, the less we found it. The more we tried to avoid suffering, the more suffering we found. And that's one of the enigmas of life. The more one tries to avoid suffering, the more one suffers. Then the next one is, all nervous symptoms are distressing, but they're not dangerous. Therefore, if the doctor is telling me your trouble is nerves, emotions, functional, then no matter how I feel, it's not dangerous. I'm not going to die from it. So keep on keeping on. That goes also in the moral field. If my spiritual advisor tells me that I'm not the worst sinner in the world, I'm not on the road to hell, then I must accept that. And although I'm scrupulous and everything else, I have to keep on accepting somebody's word for it, being objective about it. You know, nervous fatigue actually is a myth. The nerves don't wear out. They sure do distress us much, though, in life. They never kill us. That's the strange thing. But they sure can cause a lot of difficulty. Now, in order to do this, we can practice rejecting tension-causing thinking. And this is very important. And herein, recovery differs from AA insofar that it's more thorough in getting rid of resentments. Because recovery says there's two kinds of resentments. One, angry temper, the other person's wrong. Another, fearful temper, I'm wrong. Both of those causes resentments. The second way we reject tension-causing thinking is to realize that another way that we create tension is by self-analysis. I'm worse than the doctor or the psychiatrist or the clergyman says I am. Another source of tension-causing thinking is expecting danger. Looking for danger everywhere we go. That wall might fall down there. You better watch out. Could happen. You better get out of here. Then finally, the source of tension-causing thinking is looking for exceptionality either in ourselves or others. Now, how do we reject them? We reject them by either denying them or relabeling them. Therefore, if I can't deny it, if it's bugging me too bad and I can't deny it, then I can relabel it by saying, well, it's distressing, but it's not dangerous. So I go about my business. Or I can say it's average, not exceptional, and I can go about my business. So if I can't get rid of these five sources of tension, which I have just given you, and I'll repeat them, angry temper, fearful temper, self-analysis, expecting danger, and looking for exceptionality in ourselves or others, I can relabel them by telling myself they're distressing and not dangerous. They are average, not exceptional. And then we might conclude by realizing once and for all that objectivity is reality. And reality is objectivity. And the more I accept reality objectively, the less subjective reaction I will have, the less friction, the less emotional tension, the less emotional difficulties. The less danger of difficulty in the drinking field in AA. Because friction, frustration, and all those things lead to that first drink. The emotions, although they are not physical or mental or moral in themselves, the emotions can destroy the spiritual life. They can stunt the physical growth. They can make irrational the intellect of our mind, and they can prevent our return to sanity. So once more, I repeat. Reality is objectivity. Objectivity is reality. And the best way to do that, that's your job. May God bless you.